Blog Talk Radio.
Afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Red Fox Blogger. I don't know what happened to our song, Tim.
what was wrong with that then?
it faded out like a minute before it was supposed to end.
Oh.
Like, do I dare say hello? Is anybody out there?
Oh, it sounded all right at this
well,
end.
It's still playing. I don't know what happened to it. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to another fine start of the Red Fox Blogger with your host Tim Burton and Kel Fritzy, the inept one. How you doing?
Oh, yes. Good afternoon to you.
Jeez, I don't know what happened to that. I don't know what went on there.
Well, I'm not too sure because it sounded all right from where I was, so I don't know. Well, who knows? Blog Talk Radio works in mysterious ways. It's wonders to perform. I believe that's actually in in the Old Testament in certain editions. But leaving that aside, I welcome everybody who's with us tonight. And I was just looking in the chat room, and I do like the little logo that Kel puts against my name every time I sign in. I think it's supposed to be a selection of characters which makes up the face of a cat, and very tasteful it is too. So I've just tried to do one with a fox and failed miserably.
Hey, look at that.
Oh, yeah, it's I think this is the point at which most people would say, don't give up your day job, Tim. So after that, the better.
Oh, dearie me. Well, I think it's
anyway,
very,
Kel,
very
how...
cute.
Yes. All right, moving swiftly along. How the devil are you tonight, Kel? That's my question to you. How the devil
well,
are you tonight?
Well, Tim, it's funny you should ask. I'm usually infidelity fine, but Islam has caught me in a very, very, very bad mood, so I don't know if I'm as infidelity fine as I usually would be, but I'm raring to go. We've got a lot of stuff, once again, to get through. But how are you, dear man? How are you feeling?
Not too bad at all. I would say unbelievably well, but given my my health record over the past few weeks, you know, it might be they do say that after hubris, nemesis, so I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to say too much just in case halfway through the show. But I'm actually not feeling too bad, and looking forward to a packed program tonight. And I empathize entirely with what you were saying a little earlier about you get to the point sometimes where you think, if I hear another thing about Islam, I'm just going to go out and I'm going to punch somebody in the throat. And that is exactly that's exactly how I've been feeling the past days, you know. And if it wasn't for the fact that I've been ordered by the doctors to rest and not to stress myself over things, there might be a few Muslim-related people wandering around outside in the streets with holes punched in their throats. But fortunately, I've been given strict orders to rest as much as possible. So the Muslim population of Birmingham for another week. But it does sometimes get a little bit on top of you, doesn't it, Al?
Oh, it does. It does. And I think the latest in people, go up and take a look at the slides, okay? There's a few there, but there are two in particular that when I was putting the show together, at first I wanted to cry, and then when I was listening, what I tend to do is that I put all the slides together, and then I'll play the opening theme from my finder just to see if it's going to resonate, if the slides resonate with the, the theme that the show is going to go down. And I did that yesterday, and I'm looking at the slides, and at first I wanted to weep. And then I found myself becoming more and more angry and enraged. And that those two slides in particular, being Alan Henning. There's one photo of him, and he's holding, a little Islamic baby, because he was working for 8-4 Syria. He was captured. And then the next slide, he's on his knees with the lefty jihad Johnny there. And I'm looking at this, I couldn't take my eyes off the screen, Tim. And I'm just looking at these slides, and they're going back, and they're going back, and they're coming back. One of him helping, he's there to help Muslims. And then the next slide, Muslims are ready to kill him. Something washed over me, and I just became so enraged and so angry. I literally wanted to throw something across the room. But I like my things, so I don't tend to break them. But I did. I really felt like it just sat in my chest for such a long time. I had trouble sleeping. It's just, is this what they want to do to us, Tim? They want to break us psychologically?
Well, I'm sure there is a psychological factor involved in what they do, because if you look at it logistically, what is the death of one person to an organization like the Islamic State? They've shown themselves to be extremely ruthless on every level. I don't need to go into the atrocities that have been reported in the press in recent weeks and months. But beheading of individual citizens of the United States and the United Kingdom is certainly designed to have a psychological effect. Now, psychological effect is directed at our leaders, or whether it's directed at the average citizen, the average person who reads the paper, who looks on TV and sees these things going on, is a moot point. But they are certainly trying to send out the psychological message that Islam is here to dominate by fear, violence, intimidation, and terror. Now that's something that you and I and all the people who listen to our programs have known about for months, if not years, that Islam is not a benign and tolerant religion of peace. It is a political ideology, ruthless and totalitarian in nature, whose goal, whose agenda, is world domination through fear, violence, intimidation and terror. And we've known that. We've known that for a long time, and our listeners have known it for a long time as well. That's not the same thing as actually seeing the kind of things that they're capable of being broadcast on our screens, in our newspapers. I won't say day in, day out, but it's with increasing frequency. Mm-hmm. And more and more people are saying, you know, this has got to stop. You know, I understand on one level that Islam may not be the best thing since sliced bread, okay? But when you see it on your screens and in the newspapers and everywhere you look in the media, ever increasing frequency of these atrocities and beheadings and mutilations and general chaos and mayhem that they're causing, the reaction is for the average in the street to say, please make it go away, please make it stop. Because at our heart, every person in the Western world is peaceful in nature. We don't want to wish harm on our fellow man. There may occasionally be individuals and groups spring up bring out the worst in us. I mean, I was thinking of a double glazing salesman who was particularly persistent the other day, but I digress. The point is that by and large, we are peaceful. We are that's the whole essence of civilization, is to organize our societies in such a way that we can pretty much coexist in peace and harmony without too much friction taking place. And we haven't made a bad job of it in Western civilization over the years. All right, it's not perfect, but we nevertheless have constructed a framework based on Judeo-Christian principles. It's not bad, and it's darn sight better than anything that Islam can produce or is ever likely to produce, because, well, there are many reasons, but my contention is that as a framework for the advancement of civilization, the Judeo-Christian model is far better than anything that Islam is ever likely to produce. So here we are. We're going along our merry way, and all of them, this entity, the Islamic State, has sprung up, I won't say out of nowhere, because obviously if you track back in recent history, you can see cause and effect, and you can build up a picture of how the Islamic State has got to where it is today. But nevertheless, to many people who maybe don't pay too much attention to these things, it seems like only yesterday there wasn't a lot going on, and then today we've got this global entity that threatens to overwhelm the entire Middle East and destabilize not only the entire region, implications for the rest in Europe and even in the United States and Canada, you know, far away from the actual killing fields of Iraq and Syria themselves. And it's happened with such speed in terms that we do experience, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, and I'm sure you're not the only one, Kel. We could probably ask quite a few people who are listening in tonight, and we could say, do you feel that there has been almost a sea change of the intensity of the aggression and the, I won't say assertiveness, because it's much stronger than that, certainly the aggression, the bellicosity of Muslims in general, not just the Islamic State in particular, but Muslims in general? And the answer will probably come back, well, yes, there has been an order of magnitude of change in the attitudes of Muslims everywhere, not just in the Islamic State, but we're seeing it. There's all sorts of examples which we could maybe touch on in a little while, Kel, but I think that cumulatively have an enormous effect on our psychological structure, if you can talk of such a thing in general terms, of people in a relatively peaceful space. And when you see these beheadings on TV and in our media, that only adds to the general feeling of unease that people have, because we don't like to see these things. We would like for them not to happen. We would like for it all to go away, quite frankly. But the problem appears to be that our leaders don't seem to have a clue as to how to deal with it. And that, if anything, makes things 10 times worse.
We have a few clips here that we're going to play. And, Tim, what you're saying, you're resonating everything that I'm feeling. But the only psychological, well, I don't know how to put it this way, but the way that they play psychologically, all it's doing with me is that it's making me that much more belligerent towards Islam, and it's to the point where if I see a Muslim in the street, I just want to cross the road. I don't want anything to do with them. I have no interest in building bridges and making friends and singing kumbaya with these people any longer because, first of all, their silence shows consent to me. Second of all, they do have a sense of supremacy about them. They are very, very, yeah, like you say, bellicose. They're belligerent, and they are also playing a lot of cards, and I'm getting sick of the cards. I'm sick of the race card, the bigotry card, the victim card. You know, the most that Muslims can come up with is that, well, we're victimized too. This is not our religion. Well, yeah, it is your religion, and you're not taking responsibility for it. I was speaking with you earlier, and you were talking about the imams who are demanding that David Cameron say that this has nothing to do with Islam, the religion
oh,
of
yeah.
peace. God. Like,
well,
how
yeah,
stupid
I mean,
do they play
yeah.
us for? They're playing us for being stupid.
Well, yes, they are, and this is a group of imams from the UK in particular, but I'm sure we're likely to see it repeated in other Western countries. They have come together to say, well, what the Islamic State are doing is nothing to do with Islam, and in fact, we demand that David Cameron call it the un-Islamic State. You know, I mean, it's just laughable. It's laughable that they would have the brass to stand up and say that. People like you and me and our listeners and other people who've done even a minimal amount of research into the counter-jihad field, they can see instantly that Islamic State is following Islamic principles as laid down in the Quran, in the Hadith, in the Sunnah, and the example of the Islamic prophet Muhammad to the letter. They, in fact, they're going out of their way to ensure that their actions are 100% Islamic. And that's something I have written about in recent weeks. I'll try and find a link to an article which goes into this in some more detail. But where people like President Obama, Secretary of State John Kerry in the United States, David Cameron over in the UK. They say, well, Islamic State has nothing to do with Islam. Well, yes, it does. It has everything to do with Islam because they are following the Islamic principles that made Islam into what it is today. And as I'm talking to you about this, I've just pulled up another article where the French foreign minister said today that Islamic State is not representative of Islam. And this seems to be like a mass response of people of positions of authority all around the world in Western countries who ought to know better, who are going out of their way to mislead us, because what the Islamic State is doing is 100% in accordance with Islamic principles, right down to the sexual slavery of captives of the towns and cities that have been overrun, the extreme ruthlessness of in the way in which they treat their enemies, burying them alive. All this is entirely Islamic, and to say that it isn't, it does nothing at all to help solve the problem. All it does is annoy those of us who know better, and basically nobody but themselves when they come out with statements like this. They obviously are doing it in order to appease their own Muslim populations, but yeah, as a solution for the long term, it has absolutely no value at all. But I'm going to I'm just going to drop this article into the chat room concerning the foreign minister said only today, and as we move along, I'll try and I've just run into a little technical problem here, Kel, with my chat room. I'm hoping it will come back in a moment. I'm hoping it's nothing serious. I'll pass the mic back to you.
Sure. And ladies and gentlemen, we're not going to turn this into, you know, some sort of fest where we're just going to sit around and Islam, you know, is putting us in a bad mood. There's a lot of reasons why Islam should put you in a bad mood as well, because of everything that Tim just related. 5 minutes, Tim nailed it. Okay, show's over. Thanks, everyone, for stopping by. See you next week. But it's so true in that they're playing us. Islam is playing us. At least the Islamic State, they're not pretending to be anything but what they are, and that is Islamists. They are, that is Islam. It's the Muslims, the friendly guy at the corner store or the taxi driver. He's the one, or she's the one you guys got to watch out for. They're the ones engaged totally in the Kitman, Takiyah, you name it, they've got it. And they are armed to the hilt with psychological, oh, but it's not us, come on, you know, don't pick on us. Well, we are, because it is you.
Yeah.
It's exactly you. You advocate this. Your silence speaks volumes. Don't try to, you know, snow us. We're not buying the gig, baby. Like, don't even think that you can pull one over on us, because more and more people are waking up to the fact that, yes, this is exactly what Muslims do. This is how they behave. They read the Quran. If you're a Muslim, you're a Muslim. Like Ajim Chowdhury says, you can't be kind to pregnant. You're either in or you're out. And Ajim Chowdhury, as much as I despise the ban, and I think he should be arrested for sedition and treason, at least he is honest about it. Hate the guy as much as you want, but he is telling us, yes, this is Islam. This is what we do. This is how we conduct ourselves. This is all in the Holy Quran, quote unquote. So the Muslim on the street trying to convince me that I don't know what I'm talking about or I don't understand. Look, I've been around the block, you know, enough times to know exactly what I know and what I understand. So quit it with the snowball job already, because we're not buying it. If anything, you're really, really pissing me off is what you're doing. You're just really annoying me. And I am easily annoyed at the best of times. But when I go into the national dailies and the headline is Muslims feel victimized as well, it's like, oh, no, they don't. They feel exposed more than anything. They're embarrassed that the more bold ones are blowing their cover. That's what they're afraid of. They're afraid of the cover being blown. And I think that the Obama speech on Wednesday night, he offered nothing. He offered nothing in terms of how he's going to deal with the Islamic State. And I was on another radio program there, Tim, and I said, I think it was code speak for the Islamic State to tone it down a bit.
Well, yeah, I mean, that point that you made there is really quite a valid point, that there are probably a lot of Muslims there who would rather that the Islamic State toned down what they were doing for that very reason. It is making the intention of Muslims in the West much more obvious, because what we're seeing when we get these leaders standing up and saying this is nothing to do with Islam, a good rule of thumb is that when a political leader stands up and says that something is nothing to do with Islam, you can be pretty sure that it in fact has everything to do with Islam. And as a rule of thumb, if you utilize that any time in the past couple of years, you'd be pretty much on the money, because we're starting to see it a lot more now. And I don't think it's any coincidence that we're starting to see it a lot more from political leaders who ought to know better, standing up and saying this is nothing to do with Islam. The Islamic State is un-Islamic, for want of another word. And it's a complete fiction. It's a lie. It's an untruth. And it's based on nothing more than wishful thinking, because the Islamic State, as I've said before, has gone out of its way so that its actions are, in Islamic terms, completely justified. And when they take women as sexual slaves, when they behead their captives, when they have these mass executions, and other acts of extreme barbarity and ruthlessness, this is just mainstream standard Islam. There is nothing unusual about their actions at all in Islamic terms. And we, as peaceful, loving, freedom-loving Western citizens, might think it's barbaric, but in Islamic terms, there's nothing unusual about it at all. And I'm sure those Muslims are sitting there in Western countries are saying, you know, if this goes on, Islam's going to get itself a bad name. Well, Islam, in my view, has justifiably had a bad name over the past 1400 years. It's just in recent times we have forgotten about an awful thing that had happened. Let me just say, in over a 700-year period, from 792 AD to 1492 AD, give or take a few years, Spain was full of Mohammedan weasels, shall we say, and it took the Spanish 700 years to clear them all out. And that was only 500 years ago, when they threw the last of the Moors, as they were known then, back to Granada, south of Granada, and eventually across the Mediterranean back into what's now Morocco, Algeria. It took them 700 years to do it, and that was only 500 years ago. And it's as if the intervening 500 years, the Spanish have forgotten everything that they knew about Muslims and Islam at all. And they've now got a population of Muslims. All right, the Muslims have not yet seized political power and reintroduced the Sharia yet, but they're well on their way to doing it. And it's amazing how quickly we have forgotten, and I say we because, you know, we're not so very different from the Spanish in many ways, even if we haven't had an influx of Muslims prior to what we're seeing at the present day. We should have learned from history, and we should have known better, and the Spanish should have known better than to allow large numbers of Muslims into their countries, which they have done in the same way that every other European country has, we should all have known better. Did the siege of Vienna in 1683 teach us nothing? Did the fall of Constantinople in 1453 teach us nothing? Probably not, because here we are again. We're now at a point rapidly approaching, and when I say rapidly, I'm talking, you know, within a few decades, when we're going to see our Western countries completely overwhelmed, if nothing is done, by Muslims who are intent not on living with us as equals, but are intent on dominating us under Sharia law. And if that were ever to come to pass, which it might do if things continue along the lines that they are at the moment and nothing, then it will be a very, very sad day for everybody who loves freedom in not just the UK, but in Europe and in the Western world. Why have we got such a short memory span on this? Well, I dare say there's a lot of reasons, but the fact is that we ought to have known better. And Muslims are, I'm sure, keeping their fingers crossed that we don't get to wise up any more than we already are, because they're on course to take us over. And every time that something happens with the Islamic State and it makes front page, well, that's just another reason for people to be more and more suspicious of Islam and Muslims. And in my view, that suspicion, of course, is absolutely justified. We should not be tolerating Islam in any of our countries for a moment longer. That's my personal view, and I'm sure there'll be one or two people out there who perhaps sympathise with me. But yeah, you're right, Kel. They are worried about their cover being blown, and with very good reason, I would say.
And we're talking about it not for the reasons that they like. People like yourself and myself, Tim, we're talking about it because they are verifying everything we've known about Islam ever since we started educating ourselves about this political entity. they really have blown the cover this time, the Islamic State. They really did expose Islam for what it truly is. I have a clip here that we'll play, and we'll dissect this. Now, you and I, we talk a lot about the issues of Islam, but we also have very smart listeners. That includes our Sweet Susu, New Mexico, Bigfoot, Dan Butcher, Golf Dogs. I mean, all these people know this stuff. This is ABCs to them. But it's the unwashed masses that we have to worry about, because they're drinking the Kool-Aid, Tim. But if more people would listen to statements like this, we might make more of a dent in the psyche of those who say this has nothing to do with Islam, when we know it has everything to do with Islam. This is 1 minute and 13 seconds long, so let's play this one. Slow startup.
Mm-hmm.
Here we go.
My name is David Cawthorn Haynes. I would like to declare that I hold the Islamic State entirely responsible for my execution. This British man has to pay the price for your promise, Cameron, to arm the Peshmerga against the Islamic State. Ironically, he has spent a decade of his life serving under the same Royal Air Force that is responsible for delivering those arms. Your evil alliance with America, which continues to strike the Muslims of Iraq and most recently bombed the Haditha Dam, will only accelerate your destruction. And playing the role of the obedient lapdog, Cameron, will only drag you and your people into another bloody and unwinnable war.
So how is it that
if you, Cameron, persist in fighting the Islamic State, then you, like your master Obama, will have the blood of your people on your hands.
Now I think it's done.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, what we're seeing there is what you were talking about a little earlier, is it's another part of the psychological warfare that's being waged on us. Because the death of an individual citizen, whether it's from the UK or the United States, logistically makes very little difference, but the psychological impact is tremendous. We in the West are not used to seeing people killed in this horrific manner. I mean, all right, realistically, people die around the world every second of every in the most horrible ways possible. But by and large, we're shielded from it. We have been brought up with a society where a lot of the bad things that happen in the world are kept from the man in the street. And you might say on the one level, well, that's really good because you don't want people to be unduly worried or concerned about the bad things that happen in the world. But the other side of the coin is that when push comes to shove and we really do have to do something to defend ourselves against true evil, okay, and the last time I think we've had to do that on that scale, all right, this is my personal view, but I think it's quite relevant. Well, I'm talking about World War II, which was from in the 1940s, so we're talking about 70, almost 80 years ago. It was the last time we had to deal with evil on a global scale, and simply forgotten what true evil looks like, so that we're prepared for it. It has a disproportionate psychological effect on us, and I'm sure this is what we're seeing. I see this when I talk to people, when I'm out and about, when I talk to people on the radio, when I talk to them in various chat rooms, and you see their comments on websites and elsewhere in the media. I get a sense that people are being psychologically affected by this, and I'm sure it's the intent of what these people in the Islamic State, that is what they want to do. They want to beat us down psychologically, because it's like any other form of fight. And I know this from my martial arts training, that if you want to dominate your opponent, if you can achieve a psychological advantage over him, you're more than halfway there. And it doesn't matter how big and strong your opponent is, if he hasn't got the will to fight you because you've taken that will away from him, the job that much easier. And I think what the Islamic State are doing are exactly the same process, but on a larger scale.
These people, I just want to get back to that clip I played, and I'm just going to go off script for a minute here, Tim, because this ties in the video of Stephen Sotliff and David Haynes and their denigration of their their respective governments. Well, both of them were blaming the government, and they're going to die. It's obvious. They know they're dying. They know that they're going to be beheaded. It's quite obvious. But they still cling to some sort of hope that the government will save them and spare them. But they denigrate the government, and they're essentially defending the Islamic State. But it's to no avail. I don't know what I would do if I were on my knees in a desert with my hands handcuffed behind my back and some, you know, southpaw was holding a knife to my throat ready to murder me. I don't know how I would react, but it seemed that they had a sense of Stockholm syndrome. They were almost sympathetic towards the Islamic State.
Well, I have to say, it did look like that, and this isn't the first time we've seen something like this. I mean, I recall when we saw who was it? Was it Nick Berg when he was being decapitated by his captors in Iraq? I think it was. And it was a similar sort of thing. He had to read out a statement saying how the US government were to blame for what was happening. To what extent should we be saying that the sentiments expressed are really what a dying, you know, a person who knows he's about to die? To what extent should we take his words as meaning, you know, this is what he really thinks? difficult call. I'm not sure I'd want to read too much into it. I mean, I know that when you get a series of people who are being beheaded in this way, and they all say the same things, I blame my government for what it's doing. I'm not trying to be flippant, but I'm just saying part of a pattern that if you're standing there surrounded by armed men, and they're saying, well, look, you know, say what we want you to say, you might live a few moments longer, or you know, we could be holding reduces for you to say what you say. I don't know how much credibility I'd really put on it. But yeah, obviously they're trying to again, going back to the psychological warfare aspect of it, they're trying to portray themselves as doing no more than spreading the justice and the truth of Islam around the world. And if it means that people have to die in order to do it, well, that's just one of those things. So when you see their captors being made to say things, apparently of their own free will, just before they're being executed, I think you have to take it with a pinch of salt. I don't think you can really draw too much in the way of conclusions from it. You know, even though the wording of a lot of these people just before being killed is the same. Blame my government. It's entirely the government's fault. Even though this guy's taking my about to kill me with a knife, it's not him that I blame. It's my government. Well, if you can get him to say these things, obviously that's extra psychological points for you. And in that position, you know, how many people would refuse to say what was being asked of them in those circumstances when they have absolutely nowhere else to go? Don't know. I don't know how much credence I would put on it. Maybe I'm being a little unfair when I say this, but I think that those people that are near and about to be killed, they probably don't think that their government was responsible for what's happening. I mean, they might be aggrieved, if not absolutely terrified, they're in that position at the time, and they might say anything. But is it really reasonable to conclude that that's what they're really thinking at that time? I'm not sure that it is.
No, I don't think that they did. I agree with you in that in these cases they know who the enemy is. Some of the cases in particular resonate with me, especially, I encourage the people to please scroll up and look at the slides that I put in there. The one of Alan Henning really bothers me. And I put the link in the chat room for everybody. There's the videos. They're edited videos. But the one of David Henning, it doesn't look like he's drinking the Kool-Aid, but and you're right, now I'm being flippant, but what I'm trying to say is that they probably don't believe it. They were given a script, and Jeff pointed that out in the chat room, and he's right. But I would, like I said, I don't know what I'd do if I was in that situation. Would I turn to them and say, I'm not reading this bloody script, just get it over with, or what would I do? You know, these are people much more brave than myself. But I have a second clip I'm going to play, but we have a caller, Tim, and I'm going to bring her on. And this is our very own Sweet Sue from New Mexico. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Kel. Hi, Tim. You know, the discussion Hi. One thing's been bothering me about these clips, and my conclusion that they're not really sincere in what they're saying, because if you were about to die and were free to say whatever you wanted to say, wouldn't you send a message to your loved ones? Love you. You know, and you never ever hear it. Anyway, that's all I had to say, and it's been on my mind more and more, and that's why I don't believe this, what they're saying is actually coming from them. And I've also wondered if they're saying what they're saying because they've been threatened. If you don't say this, we will kill your family, we will kill someone you know. And that's what I think's going on. Anyway, thank you, and I'll go back on mute.
Thank you, Sue, so very much. Two very, very salient points there, Tim. Yeah, they know where these people live, and that did cross my mind. Just before the boom would come down, I would get in a quick, and I love you so-and-so, and my children, I love you, I love you, I love you. They didn't have an opportunity to do that. And yes, Sue, I never thought about that, is that they were coerced into relating these words because they have the addresses of the families.
Yes.
I don't know. That's good.
Well,
yeah.
it could be a factor. I'm sure if they wanted to find out personal details like that, it wouldn't be a problem for them. You know, if you've got somebody captive in, you've got pretty much every opportunity to find out whatever you want to find out about their personal lives, and it's highly unlikely that any details would have been held back. So, you know, that is always a possibility. Which really just what I was saying earlier is that when they stand in or kneel in front of the camera and say these things, just before the execution, you probably can't read too much into it for the same reasons that Sue was talking about. Yeah, okay. I'd say it obviously has a lot of value from a psychological terrorism point of view if the killers can get their captives to say those things just prior to their execution, but I really don't think you should read too much into them. But my saying that doesn't diminish the psychological effect that it does have on people who are simply unused, as we are. We're unused to seeing barbarity on this kind of scale, and that's why it has the effect that it does.
We have another clip here we're going to play. We listened to the statement by David Cawthorn Haynes. Now we have one here from journalist Stephen Sotliff, and this one is 1 minute and 42 seconds long, so we'll take a listen to this one as well.
Exactly who I am, Stephen Joel Sotliff. I'm sure you know exactly who I am by now and why I am appearing before you. And now it is time for my message. Obama, your foreign policy of intervention in Iraq was supposed to be for the preservation of American lives and interests. So why is it that I'm having to pay the price of your interference with my life? Am I not an American citizen? You've spent billions of U.S. taxpayers' dollars, and we've lost thousands of our troops in our previous fighting against the Islamic State. So where's the American people's interest in reigniting this war? From what little I know about foreign policy, I remember a time when you could not win an election without promising to bring our troops back home from Iraq and from Afghanistan and to close down Guantanamo. Here you are now, Obama, nearing the end of your term and having achieved none of the above, and deceivingly marching us, the American people, into a blazing fire.
I'm back, Obama. And I'm back because of your arrogant foreign policy towards the Islamic State, because of your insistence in continuing your bombings in Al-Mal, Zumar, and the Mosul Dam, despite our serious warnings. You, Obama, have yet again, through your actions, killed yet another American citizen. So just as your missiles continue to strike our people, our knife will continue to strike the necks of your people. We've entered this evil alliance of America against the Islamic State to back off and leave our people alone.
And that's Lefty there speaking in the end there, Tim.
Well, I was going to say I'm struck by the way that the response of our political leaders has been to go into overdrive and say, well, we're going to find out who this guy is and we're going to track him down, we're going to incorporate special forces, we're not going to rest until he's brought to justice. I mean, all very commendable, and you know, it probably gives a little bit of comfort to the families of the victims involved, but it's not the answer. I had an analogy which I was talking to you about earlier, Kel, and with your permission, I'll reproduce it. It's something that I used to say
quite
frequently when I was on other radio shows, and it's as if, okay, we go back 1944, on a street in northern France. And there's a platoon of German soldiers armed with rifles and other weapons and explosives coming down the street. And it's as if we arrest these German soldiers, we throw them in prison, and we prosecute them as individual criminals for having possession of firearms, ammunition, and explosives on a French street. Okay? This is, it's completely inappropriate. An action like that would just be unreasonable, and it would be unreasonable because you're not looking to prosecute individual criminals. What you're looking to do, and what we were looking to do back, with my analogy in 1944, what we were looking to do was to strike the ideology that caused those soldiers to be on the streets where they were at that time. Place. It was the Nazi ideology that was the impetus behind the build-up of the German army prior to World War II. It was the Nazi ideology that caused divisions of the German army to advance into various countries in Europe during World War II. And we really won the war by defeating the ideology. We totally crushed the ideology until it was no longer a threat to us. And when I say crushed, I mean that absolutely. It was completely and utterly crushed. The high command was totally crushed. Adolf Hitler was found, so we're told anyway, dead in his bunker in Berlin in 1945. And the senior commanders were subsequently put on trial after the war was over and executed. And at that point, the Nazi ideology was not only completely crushed, but any prospect of it arising in a serious form afterwards was minimalized. And that's exactly what we should be doing with Islam. Although it gives everybody involved a nice feeling if they say they're going to go off after the individual killer, Jihadi John, as he's apparently known. That is,
I call him Lefty.
Yeah, okay. Southpaw, yeah. It's all well and good, and it no doubt gives comfort to the individual families, but as a war strategy, it's completely unrealistic. We should be going after the ideology, and we're not going to do that while leaders of our various nations are busy saying Islam is a religion of peace, because Islam is the problem. Islam ideology behind what is happening. Not radical Islam, not fundamental Islam, not extremist Islam. Islam pure and simple, mainstream Islam that is outlined in the Quran and Sunnah and has been practiced by Muslims for the past 1400 years in one form or another. This is an important point. This is not just a minor point here, because if it's in the Quran and Sunnah, then it's Islam. Okay, it's not rocket science. There is no magic there's no magic behind it. It's Islam is outlined in the Quran and Sunnah. If it's in the Quran and Sunnah, then it's Islam. If it is not in the Quran and Sunnah, then it is not Islam. So it's quite easy to determine what is and what isn't Islam. But because it's hard for a lot of people to take the trouble to look through the Sunnah, the Hadith, and the Sirah to see what's involved and how Islam is constructed from these texts. Our leaders are taking the opportunity to say it's nothing to do with Islam, and as long as they do, we're never going to be able to solve this problem. We have to stand up and say the problem is the ideology. The problem is not the individuals that commit these atrocities. Okay, yeah, it'd be very nice if we could descend on them and pluck them out of wherever they're hiding and bring them to trial. Well, all right, do that anyway if you think it's going to score some political points somewhere, that's fine. But never forget, the ideology is the problem. It's the ideology that needs to be defeated. And we will have peace. We will never solve this problem until we have spoken out and identified that ideology. That's what you need to do. And this is you. This requirement to know your enemy is a requirement that has been known by generals and people who are in charge of fighting wars for thousands of years. Sun Tzu, a Chinese general from thousands of years ago, I think 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, wrote never mind what the book was called, but The Art of War, sorry. And in The Art of War, he said one of the very first things you must do is know your enemy. You must not be afraid to identify your enemy, because if you do not, you'll never win the war against him. And this is something that our political leaders at the moment seem determined not to. They don't want to win this war at the moment. They want the war to go away. But they don't want to win it. They want to think that it's going to go away. Of course, it isn't. Islam will never go away of its own accord. Why would it? The tactics that Muslims have used over the past 1,400 years to propagate Islam have, by and large, worked pretty well. And if they can continue doing what they're doing and suppress the truth and propagate Islam by lies and deceit, as Muslims have been doing for the past 1,400 years, why would they change? Why would they change that? So it's up to us to physically stop it. And we have become so unused to confronting evil, certainly in the 70-80 years since World War II. We've become so unused to it that our political leaders just think that it's totally politically unacceptable to fight against real evil, and Islam is the essence of real evil. And people might say, "Ah, you can't make that judgment. You know, what is good, what is evil? It all depends on your point of view." Well, no, I disagree. There are things that even a child can understand are evil as opposed to good. Even a child can understand some of these things before they've been taught formally in schools as to the nature of what's good and evil, and when whether a particular culture or a particular religion or civilization is good or evil. Small children know the difference. You know, why is it so difficult for us to say that Islam is thoroughly evil? It's against everything that is good in humanity, and it needs to be crushed. It doesn't just, I mean, ultimately, to crush it may take a long, long time, but we need to certainly constrain it and stop it getting any worse than it currently is. And then we have to drive it back and to crush it and get rid of it from the face of the planet. Now, people will listen to this and say, "Oh, Tim, that sounds amazing. You know, can't you live and let live?" Well, I would like nothing better than to live and let live. The problem is that Islam simply will not allow it.
Exactly. I want to move into a new area in a moment. We're going to take a break in a few moments, but what you're saying, everything you're relating, I'm trying to absorb it. And the psychological warfare is still resonating with me, and that we played the clips with David Cawthorn-Haynes and Alan. Now they have Alan Henning that they're threatening to behead. We played the clip with. I lost my notes, Tim. Don't worry about it, folks. I mean, you're smart listeners. You don't need me to recite names. But these were two journalists. But now they're going after humanitarian workers. One of the journalists was also a humanitarian worker, but this one was working for means of being a human being. He was helping people in Syria. He was working for the organization called Aid for Syria. He wasn't a journalist. He wasn't a politician. He was just a compassionate human being that wanted to help people. And he was a cab driver, and he took a leave of absence from his job to help these people. Now, they're killing humanitarian workers, Tim.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they are humanitarian workers means very little to them. What they want is citizens of particular countries, particularly the United Kingdom and the United States, and it matters not that they're humanitarian workers as opposed to journalists. One UK citizen or one US citizen will do just as well as any other. I mean, we see that I can't find the article straight away, but I'm sure I read today that Islamic State have pledged to attack United Kingdom and United States interests everywhere in the world. It's not just what's happening in Iraq and Syria, and it's not just on their home territories, but what they're saying is that United Kingdom citizens or United States citizens everywhere in the world will be considered legitimate targets for IS sympathisers to attack and kill. And that could obviously mean, you know, tourists today, for example. So the fact that they're targeting humanitarian workers, I mean, yeah, it seems ironic in one way that they're targeting the very people who've gone out there in order to help Muslims and make their lives better. But from the ISIS point of view, one Westerner is as good as another. And, we might like to say, well, isn't it awful that they've targeted humanitarian workers? Well, yes, it is. It is awful. But from their point of view, they see no difference. Because they're after the psychological impact, one US citizen or one UK citizen will do just as well as another.
Yeah. And we played those two clips, and my apologies to the listeners for being remiss in recalling their names, but the first one we played was with David Haynes and his statement. The second one we played was journalist Stephen Sotliff with his statement. We don't know what's going to happen, but I think we can easily assume that Alan Henning will be executed probably within the week. And Tim and I were speaking about this before we came to air because we wanted to know in which direction we were going to take this program today. You brought up a really good point, Tim, about it might not just be one at a time anymore. But I want you to expand on that. But right now we're going to take that break so that people can refresh their coffees and their teas or whatever it is they're imbibing in. And ladies and gentlemen, it's 5 o'clock somewhere, okay? So whatever you like. I also want to apprise you of a programming note, okay? Mike Holt of Restore Australia, you're used to hearing here Wednesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. His program will now be heard 8 p.m. Eastern Time. That is 10 a.m. Australian time, standard AST time. Keep that in mind. But we will be back in 5 minutes. Now, you're going to be familiar with this song because this is mine and Tim's normal opening song, but we have changed it to another song because we stand with Israel, and as long as Israel is under siege, we will show our solidarity in playing Ofra Hazza for you every Monday. But this is courtesy of Vlad Tepes. This is 9:29, and we'll see everybody back here in 5 minutes and 30 seconds.
Believe not in God and the lost day.
And hi, everybody, and welcome back to the program. Just to remind you, you are listening to the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Tim Burton, and Kel Fritzy. Thank you to everybody who is joining us, and thank you to Sue from New Mexico for calling in. Well, she's our sweet Sue. We want to thank Bigfoot. Jeff from the English Defense League radio show is here, and we have Golf Dogs Moving Forward, a guest. We've had people pop in and out, and we thank everybody who listens in the archive, and we know that you do. Well, on a personal note, Tim and myself, we are also the co-hosts at the Radio Jihad Network. We are the freedom-loving infidels, and you can hear us there Tuesday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. And we want to thank you very much for making that show a success. We are a young show over there, but we're on page one this week, so we must be doing something right there, Tim. So Tim and myself, we are grateful for your listenership.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Thanks to everybody who's tuned in and help us to make the show what it is. I'm pleased that it resonates with people, and well, what can I say? It's all down to the producer, in my view, and that's our lovely Kel Fritzy, the finest producer a red-blooded male could wish for, and doing a wonderful job on that show as on so many others.
I try my best, and I get teased a lot, Tim, about when there's a radio host and I'm in the chat room and they're doing a roll call. It's like, and we have Kel of the Red Fox Blogger joining us tonight, and I'm not even going to mention the shows that she does because they're too numerous to count. And the big joke is that God invented 8 days just for me.
Oh, yeah. Yes, just in case you didn't know, ladies and gentlemen, Kel does a sterling job of producing. Well, it's got to be 10 shows, is it? Well, certainly at its peak. I know you were doing at least 10 shows.
Pardon me. Yeah. I do a lot of work for various radio shows. One in particular, of course, is the English Defense League radio show. That's one I do. I also sit with Annie and Dan of Southern Sense. I produce for Vlad Tepes, and he is Islamic Issues. I, of course, produce for the Red Fox Blogger, and I produce and co-host with you at the Radio Jihad Network. So it is busy, and I know a lot of people say, well, you know, how do you do it? How do you find the time? Well, because there is one motivator, and it's called defeating the scourge. And we know the scourge as Islam. And this is the theme that we have been touching upon throughout the program, is that I'm not intimidated, nor is Tim. We're not going to back down from our mission statement being that we are here to educate. pardon me. It's, if anything, they're just making me more and more angry, Tim. And if they feel that they can run roughshod over us, and they think that there is going to be some sort of psychological trauma visited upon us, well, they have another thing coming, because we're too smart. We're on to them, and we are totally on to Islam. The last hour, people, we were talking about the victimhood that Muslims feel and why they don't deserve it, because they know exactly what's going on, and they're just trying to play us there, Tim. But you know what? We do have another caller, and I know who this is. Hello, 5071. What's your name and what's your comment?
England calling.
Hiya, Jeff.
Hi, Tim. Hi, Kel. I had to do something a little bit. You know, my entrance has got to be a little bit different. It's good
what
to be
like.
That's amazing, Jeff. You know, it was be like an English presenter from the radio 1940s, you know.
I tried to reflect times of old when knights were bold and, you know.
Dan Rather accent.
I love that one.
Oh, my goodness me. You put me on the spot. Now, how do I do me Dan Rathers now? What do I do? I can't think now. My mind's gone blank. How do I normally do it? Give me an insight on it. What do I do?
And reporting
from the United Kingdom is our very own Jeff, and also in the middle side of England is our very own Mr. Tim Burden. How about that?
Oh, very good.
Actually, yeah, that was terrible today. You know what, ladies and gentlemen, I put Jeff on the spot, but when we're talking and something out of the United States might come up, he will mimic the perfect American accent. It's amazing. I don't even know I'm
speaking
to.
Well, sure do, ma'am. Sure do, ma'am. One's got to do what one's got to do. Listen, my English accent here.
Yes,
Jeff, you do a terrible English accent, by the way.
Anyway, that's a little bit under the belt there, Jeff.
But how are you, Jeff? How are you today? And
I'm sorry, thank you so much for calling. Talking over Sim as well, Kel. My apologies.
No.
Sim, you were trying to interject there, young man.
I was only going to say the American accent is so realistic. I can visualise you sitting there right now in your kitchen, with your cowboy hat and your six gun, taking pot shots.
As John Wayne would say, get off your horse and drink your milk.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
But anyway, all this frivolity. You was talking about some, yourself and Tim were talking about some very serious things that's what we've been seeing going on in this beautiful, sad world that we live in at this moment in time. And what can I say? Sometimes, you know, the words, there's so much you want to say, and the whole severity of what's going on, it just leaves you short of what to say. What to say? Do you know what I'm saying, girl? We as a self, citizen journalists, that is very difficult for us to be stuck for words sometimes. And I don't know about yourself, Tim, but when I talk about these, you can't be light-hearted about what's going on to our good people. Go there to try to help people. My goodness me, just don't understand the mentality of these people. They, because you're an infidel, you're a kuffar, or you represent the United Kingdom, you're their enemy, and they're going to dispose of you, and they're going to put you out there. They're going to make you say things. Because probably that gentleman you're talking about, Gilda, I did make a little comment. He was probably said, look, I can make it easy or hard for you. You speak this script, and I guarantee your death will be quick, and it'll be nearly pain-free. You can imagine what they do. And these gentlemen, I mean, come on, most of us would say, you know what, you stick your script up your backside, but you're on the spot. It's okay for us to sit here and say what we're saying, what we've done. But that gentleman in that position, and the other people gone before him, you know, they've been scripted up, and you know, they, well, what must go through these poor people's minds? They must be thinking their family, their loved ones, and knowing that their loved ones are going to end up sitting or hearing about these videos. It's absolutely horrible, and this is what it's meant to be. It's supposed to cause, the confusion amongst the leaders of our countries. That's the whole idea about it. It's politicised, I would say, these poor people that meet there.
Absolutely. Yeah, Jeff, exactly. Sue brought up a really good point, though, and I never really thought about this, that they probably force-fed these scripts because they were threatening family members or something. We don't know. We may never know, but... That is a very good point that I never considered. I don't think that they would be interested in pursuing anything, say, in the United States or in the UK, but the way that we are reading these people, we do not know the depth of their depravity. I don't think we know yet just how deep they go and what they are truly capable of. And if they have, we know they have operatives in Canada, the United States.
You mean sleeper cells, Kel?
The UK, the sleeper cells, exactly. We know that Obama opened the southern borders, and they're coming across that way now because they are brown-skinned, and they mix right in. They mix right in the United States, but they're here.
It's the demise, isn't it, of our countries and nations, what's happening there, isn't it? It's the demise. I mean, I think Tim would grasp that fact. It's the demise of, population replacement with people who want to do the good citizens of our country's harm. Population replacement, social engineering.
Yeah.
It's worked its way over the years, and we stand before us all today with a dilemma of politicians divvying around what to do. I think most of us are sitting there. We know what they should do. They should bomb them out of existence. That's the way I look at it, Kel. No ifs, no buts. These people are wanting to cause the death and destruction of people right away across this world. They want their caliphate. They want to bring about this this darkness of our times. And you can't dither around with these people. You just got to take them out of the picture. Whatever people think about me, you know, you get a lot of lefties. That's a bit extreme. Well, you know what? Extreme times take extreme measures, make extreme measures. So I would just say that to the people that want to go wag a finger at you and say, well, this is not the right way to go. Well, what other bloody way to go? There's people trying to kill us all. you know what I mean, Kel?
Oh, absolutely. And we do have somebody here that will agree with what you say, and that's Michael Green. I'm going to bring him on in a moment.
Oh, great.
But I wanted to ask Tim a question, too, and that is... We were when Tim and I go over our show notes. Tim, you brought up a really good point about it might not be too long down the road when we see two or three in one video being beheaded, because that's the amount of hostages they're capable of procuring. And Tim, do you think that will be a possibility? Do you think they are going to amp it up that way?
Well, I certainly think it's a distinct possibility, and for this reason, when we were talking about it earlier, we were talking about the impact that the psychological element has on peaceful citizens like ourselves, and you know, it's quite a substantial psychological element. We are not used to seeing people behaving in this barbaric fashion, and once you've started to introduce kind of behaviour into the media so that it's broadcast amongst us peaceful citizens, you know, a certain level of unease, if not actual outright alarm, is very easily generated. But of course, if you start to behead people one at a time over a period of a few weeks, pretty soon, you know, people will think, oh, it's just another beheading, it's Friday, you know, this is what we've come to expect. So if you use this kind of behaviour as a psychological weapon, you certainly do not want to ease up. And they are certainly going to have no shortage of prisoners that they're going to be able to get hold of from, certainly from the United Kingdom or the United States. I'm sure that it'd be more prisoners, even if they don't have them now, they'll get hold of them, who are nationals of these countries. And if we suddenly see that instead of just one person being beheaded over the course of a week or 10 days or whatever, we see two or three, maybe even more, four or five, being beheaded in quick succession, this is going to have the effect of keeping on the psychological pressure. And given that the main purpose, in my view, of them participating in this kind of activity at all is primarily for psychological warfare reasons. I think they have every reason to keep the pressure on and to acts of even more barbarity, which might include, you know, more people, more than one person being beheaded at a time. So I think there's a very big chance that that will happen. I'd be, you know, delighted to be proved wrong and for these kind of things not to happen at all and not to be present on our screens and in our newspapers and so on. But certainly if I were looking to assess the effect that psychological warfare has, I would be looking to aim for maximum effect and to keep the pressure on all the time. As I said before, a psychologically defeated enemy is somebody who's very very much easier to overcome than somebody who's prepared to back when you make your aggressive move. So they have every reason to do that in view, and it wouldn't surprise me if they do.
Well, there's 44 or 45 of them. I hope you didn't mind, Gil. There's another 48.
No, go ahead.
So the story goes, there's about 44 or 45 that they've got lined up already. So we do know there's another Englishman or British gentleman who's ready to meet the same fate. Yeah, and it is very well, I do believe that, you know, any backward steps or anything, it just spur them on, and you will see a lot more of what we've been seeing. I do believe that we need to go after them. We need to drone them. I've seen a good video last week of them going after the bad guys. You know, they're the bad guys, and they're doing a great job. I think we just need to continue doing that around the clock, if need be. We've got eyes in the sky, haven't we, Kel and Tim? You know,
we absolutely do. And what I'd like to do is that Michael Green has been sitting rather patiently for a few moments here. I would like to have him put in what his thoughts are about this. And Michael Green, you've been listening to the program for a bit now, and you've got the thread of what we are discussing. And in particular, we've been discussing the psychological effects of Islamic State and the depths of depravity in which they can sink. And I think that we're just scratching the iceberg. And Michael, welcome to the program. First of all, it's great to hear your voice again. And what do you think?
Hey, Kel, and a big hello to Tim and to Jeff in the UK. And Tim's in the UK also.
Hiya, Michael.
Hey, it's great to hear
you,
gentlemen.
Good to hear your voice, Michael.
Thank you, Jeff. It's wonderful to hear you. You're a tremendous, outstanding patriot of your country and a great counter jihadist.
So are you, sir. So are you.
But I'm trying. Let me make a few points first that I really, I'm just kind of overflowing with disgust. We have two men, both are the respective leaders of their nations, the most powerful countries on the face of the earth with the most vast military assets and military might to crush and destroy evil bastards. Now, with that said, Obama comes up with an absurd plan, not to get into Obama's plan. It's absurd. It won't work. One of the worst things of his plan is to spend money and time equipping and training so-called rebels in Syria. They're all Muslim fascists. All those rebels would cut our head off in the second it would take to say, Allahu Akbar. Okay, that's no good. No ground troops on the ground. No combat troops in theater. Another bad move. I want to get to David Cameron now because I'm quite disgusted with him.
Mm-hmm.
He said on one hand, he said, it's basically a quote, that he will do whatever is necessary to take down this group. Then, within the same time he's speaking, he makes this statement. He says, this is not about British combat troops on the ground. It's about working with others to extinguish this terrorist threat. Did not these two men understand that we were at war, that war has been declared on us, that no war has ever been won, no war can ever be won without at some point sending in ground troops? It's just astounding to me. You know what it is? It just shows such a weak and gutless, cowardly disposition to not insert into this war men and women who need to be on the ground at some point to kill the bastards. You can't win a war from the air. You know, drone strikes don't make it. Isolated airstrikes from American F-18 fighter jets, which is what's been done to date, about 150 to 160 airstrikes the U.S. has done in about 45 days. It's done very little to degrade them, done very little to, you know, push them back. It's pathetic. It's sickening. Another point I want to make that's got me even more angry, both these idiots, Obama and Cameron, feel a need, a compelling need, when they talk about these scumbags, is to say that they're not Islamic and it's not part of Islam and to defend Islam and to defend Muslims. Now, what is this crap? It's not about, you know, who are they? I mean, I didn't know that David Cameron and Barack Obama are both experts on Islam. Of course, they don't know anything about Islam.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know their arse from their elbow. But in the context of saying that we need to fight them, they feel this compulsion to protect the ideology, of course, that's fueling them. So, you know, we really have a problem here.
We're on a losing battle, if that's the case with these politicians, that Michael, and I hope you don't mind me interjecting there, Carol.
No.
But all the time all the time we got people like Cameron, and all the time we got someone like Obama. We're on a losing battle. We need to really pull our resources together and go after them, and don't stop until we've totally destroyed them. I'm like yourself, Michael. I do believe that they need to be totally eradicated. And the whole idea, and what annoys me is when they say this has got nothing to do with Islam. You know, how many times does David Cameron, how many times does Obama got to say that? We are at war with Islam. We all know it,
yeah.
But we got politicians who are not stating it. We know it, and it's about time they did, because this is a war that we got to meet head-on, and we've got to be brutal as they are, Michael.
Right.
I think you would agree with me there. But that's the war, and we're not. It turns my stomach over to think that we've got people in power who's in big control of nuclear weapons even, that are sitting back, saying that Islam is a religion of peace, and all the time this ideology is slowly but surely eradicating the good people in this world. The Christians, the Jews, the Hindus, the Sikhs, they're a total evil entity in this world that we've never seen before in the 21st century. We thought we'd seen it with Hitler and the Nazis. This makes that look, panders into the insignificance with what we've got before us all now. I just have to say that, Kel.
Oh, Jeff, you nailed it. I'm doing fist pumps in the air going, yes, yes, because you're so totally right on the money. And Tim touched upon this at the beginning of the program, and that, Tim, your analogy about Nazi soldiers walking down the streets of France.
See, the problem is, if I can interject, the big problem is that both governments in the United States and in the UK, they see this as a counterterrorism situation. It's not about counterterrorism. Counterterrorism is on the home front. It's a war. And everyone's afraid to say that we need to go to war and that we are at war, and more so they're afraid and reluctant to understand that in war you have to have a ground force. And that means that people will become harmed, you know. They'll be killed on the battlefield, tragically, or they'll be seriously wounded. But I know for a fact that the men and women of Her Majesty's forces and the men and women of the United States military, and certainly the Canadians, are willing to go and take that risk. They're willing to risk their life to kill these bastards who have made it clear that they have every intention to kill us. But they can't do their job. They're not being let to do the job that they signed up for, especially the ones that go into infantry, you know, and it's about that. And people who say that we can't put boots on the ground or we shouldn't put boots on the ground are really clueless. They don't understand what we're facing. Right now, ISIS is pulling in $3 million a day in oil. They have vast financial resources. That money equals buying power. They will be able to buy all kinds of weaponry, and I'm not talking about small weapons. I'm talking about heavy weapons. I'm talking about things called MANPADs, which are surface-to-air missiles that have a range of 16,000 miles that can easily shoot down a commercial airliner. And now the intelligence info is out. Originally, it was 10,000 fighters estimated in their strength, and now it's been tripled to about 32,000, and they're growing exponentially. Day by day, every day we sit and do very little, their ranks are being filled with more and more murderous, fanatical jihadists.
Yeah, well, Michael, if you don't mind, I was going to say, you know, the way that it makes you feel that we should have some, even a military move against our politicians so we can at least take the fight to these people. Because the one we got, I'm talking about, I'm probably going to get arrested, open rebellion, you know, to remove these people and get self sorted and organised to sort these people out once and for all. Let's have our final crusade against these people. Let's totally eradicate them. Let's have a peaceful world. Let's think of the future. Let's think of our children, our grandchildren, because that's what it all comes down to. The end. We're fighting for the survival of our future generations, because the what they're doing, they are bringing definite destruction to our streets and our cities, and it does take probably extreme things to put things right.
We don't want to advocate.
Yeah, Michael, wrap up your point, because I have another mini topic that I want to bring up, and Tim and I were discussing this. So, Michael, please go ahead and respond to that, and then we'll move into the final topic of the evening.
Sure. I just want to wrap it up by saying that I think I identified correctly the serious problem with the unwillingness to wage war, to prosecute a war, to use a ground force at some point. The problem in Syria, as a matter of fact, there's a report out now that ISIS has stricken up a deal. They have made a deal with several so-called moderate Syrian groups, rebel groups, excuse me, fighting in Syria. There's a lot of information out there, and it's a real bad situation. Nobody has the answers. You know, we have to be careful about overthrowing our governments. It's not legal. I can understand frustration. There's a lot of frustration, you know, on both sides of the Atlantic, but at the same time, we just got to be careful. And
I understand not much that, Michael. Good point that you make there.
It's
anger in myself, you know.
Yeah, anger and frustration is understandable emotions in the light of the crisis we're facing, but once again, let's keep a level head and see what's going to happen moving forward. I want to say my condolences to you Brits, you know, for the slaughter of that man. I do want to say one last point, and then I'll close it out, is that I'm really disappointed that his brother made a statement about the loss of his life. And in the context of that statement, he had to say that Islam didn't have anything to do with it. You know, it's just, what is the obsession? What is the story with people today? If you believe that Islam didn't have anything to do with your brother's death, then keep it to yourself and keep your mouth shut and just stick to the facts that he's gone, tragically, and that a bunch of savages decapitated him.
Absolutely. We are down to our last 20 minutes, and there was a final topic that I wanted to bring up, Tim and myself wanted to bring up, and the theme of the program tonight, ladies and gentlemen, has been the psychological warfare. Michael, you bring up an excellent point in that, level heads must prevail. But that doesn't mean that we cannot get angry about it. I'm furious. I'm fed up. Tim, when we go over the show notes together, he hears it in my voice, and he knows that it's affecting me. But it's affecting me in a way that is just hardening my resolve to ensure that Islam is a defeated entity in the West. But the final thing I want to close out with, and Tim and I touched upon this, is Sally Jones. And if you people are not familiar with Sally Jones, well, she is a she converted to Islam, and now her name is Hussein al-Britani. And she was the one who declared that she wanted to be the first woman to slaughter an infidel. You look at this woman, she blonde-haired, she had two boys, she abandoned her two sons to marry a Islamic extremist. She is fronting a Sharia group. She's part of the Sharia police now there in Syria. She is the one, like I say, wants to be the first woman jihadi to slaughter an infidel. This is a convert. She is in her 20s. She's left the UK. They cannot find her. They don't know where she is. They think she's in the same area in which all of these beheadings are going on. They think that she might have had associations with Lefty there, who beheaded all of these people, and now she's gone. Like she's gone. She's over there, and you look at a photo of her, and she looks like a ballet doll, and she's playing the guitar, and she looks pretty hip. She's a everything that a young girl should be growing up in the West. And then you look at another photo of her, and she's got the full niqab on, sporting an AK-47. Now, this is becoming a very large problem for everybody in the West. Canada, the United States, the United Kingdom, unfortunately, has the dubious distinction of exporting jihadists who want to fight alongside the Islamic State. Australia is now experiencing such a dire issue that they have put their terror alert on high as well. And Tim, when you and I talked about this, we were wondering, what are we going to do with these people upon their return? Do we strip them of their citizenship, or what, do we arrest them? And the government is talking about de-radicalization programs. Like that's just insane.
Well, all of these measures sound marvelous on the face of it, and they're designed to placate a public which is becoming increasingly concerned, uneasy, and alarmed. And so it's a very easy thing for a politician to stand when they come back, and we're going to strip them of their citizenship, and we're going to put them through de-radicalization courses. Well, if I just look at each of those in turn, if I may, just briefly, I know we're running out of time, but if we're talking about arresting people when they come back, you're going to have proof that they've actually been somewhere you didn't want them to go. I was on holiday in Turkey visiting my sick aunt, and I went to the border just to look at the sunset in Syria, and all of a sudden this jihadi jumped on me and forced me to go into 3 weeks worth of training where I learnt how to use explosives and weapons. It's not my fault. So when they come back to the UK, what are you going to arrest them and charge them? You know, are you going to be able to prove that they were there in the first place? Are you going to be able to prove that they went through a weapons course or fought on behalf of Iraq, the ISIS group in Iraq and Syria? Of course you're not going to be able to prove it. And even if you could, I mean, you might, for example, have enough evidence to get maybe two or three people returning who've had the misfortune to come through UK passport control with their rocket-propelled grenades still strapped to their back in a fit of absent-mindedness, and you can execute them. But they are highly unlikely to be able to reach any significant number of people who've been out there, fought for ISIS, come back, because you simply will not be able to put And the second thing is, what are you going to do? Strip them of the, all right, you might arrest them. Are you going to strip them of their citizenship? Well, then you run into legal problems, because if they've only got citizenship of one country, it's illegal to take that at the moment. It's illegal to take that citizenship away from them and leave them stateless. So you've got all sorts of legal implications there. All right, you might pass a law which says, well, this is a matter of national security, we're going to take away the niceties of international law. But that's a very dangerous route to go down, because then all sorts of liberties and freedoms could be taken away once you start discarding international law willy-nilly. And the third thing is de-radicalization. Well, it's been tried in many countries, and it's found to be well, I won't say completely ineffective, but the levels of effectiveness are so low as to render that course of action almost completely useless. Places like, believe it or not, Pakistan, Indonesia, Malaysia, all moderate Muslim countries, as if there were such a thing, they have been through de-radicalization programs. And they've tried to take away the desire for Muslims to wage jihad. Well, that's a very difficult thing to do, considering that Islam requires every able-bodied Muslim, devout Muslim, to wage jihad on behalf of Islam. That's an actual Islamic requirement. So how do you about taking that requirement and telling people that it's not actually part of Islam when it obviously is? So the attempt at de-radicalization is doomed to failure on that basis alone. And that's why I say these three measures, whether you're talking about arresting people, taking away their citizenship, or de-radicalizing, they are just not going to work. And they're just doomed to failure. And the only reason they're out there, those measures are out there in the first place, is to try and placate people who don't know the first thing about Islam. Now, you know, we, all of us here, understand the threat, and we should be able to say, well, measures like this are not going to work. This is warfare. This is, as Michael Green said, we are at war Islam, not through our own choice, but because Islam has declared war on us. If we're going to accept that premise, and I think we should, then the only rational solution is to pull out all the stops and completely crush Islam as an ideology, and to take away its support everywhere we can. And I'm not just talking about Iraq and Syria. I'm talking about taking away the ability of Muslims to wage war against us on our, in our own countries. And if that means discrimination against Muslims, or anybody who voluntarily subscribes to the alien and hostile ideology of Islam, then so be it. We are going to have to grasp that nettle at some point. And that's my two cents on the subject. And I know we're coming down to the wire, Kel, so I'm going to pass the microphone back to you.
Oh, absolutely. And what I would like to do is that I want to give Jeff a couple of moments to expand on that, because both of you being in the United Kingdom, this is a very affecting situation that you and Tim are living, Jeff.
It certainly, we're living in really extraordinary times. Scale often said this, that never thought that I'd see a day come that our poor world would be in such a state through Islam. You know, there's a lot, many people going back, never thought that this so-called religion of peace, and I used to just take it, well, you know, people say, oh, well, it's a religion of peace, that's okay. Didn't realise the implications, didn't know about it until I started to look into it and study it, like itself and like Tim and like many others. When you realise what we got before us now, and the famous people actually pre-warned us of the situation, what we would be expecting. I'd have probably said, been the same, you're having a laugh, this is a joke. But now I know it's real, it's up close, it's very personal. We're having citizens of our country being beheaded publicly, you know, put on the internet for the whole world to see. These are the times we live, and with extreme, you know, these extreme people doing extreme things, then we must answer them in the same way. But anyway, Kel, I know you're running down, but I've got to once again thank you for letting me join your panel this evening.
Thank you, Tim
and Mr. Michael Green. It's always a pleasure. And Kel and Tim, great show as usual. God bless you guys. You've been fantastic works.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff.
Oh,
speak to you soon.
Thank you, Jeff.
You
guys. And Michael, I'm going to give you a couple of minutes to close out your thoughts as well.
Thanks, and thanks, Jeff. President George Bush in 2007, President George Bush made a statement. Context of his statement, he clearly put forth that if we were to leave Iraq precipitously to withdraw all our forces, then what would come in after that would be worse than what had been. Al-Qaeda in Iraq, they're a bunch of Boy Scouts compared to these scumbags.
Mm-hmm.
And tragically, the president was right. Now we face a greater threat, an existential threat. We have thousands and thousands of jihadis from Europe with European passports, hundreds from America, a sizable number from Canada,
mm-hmm.
over there, getting trained, learning the use of weapons, explosives, and worse, getting that ideology in their veins. It's like a drug, you know. Once it gets into their bloodstream, it goes into their bone marrow. There was a statement by this savage Mohammedan who executed several Jews at a Jewish museum in Belgium recently, and he was interviewed. He's been apprehended, and he said that it was a wonderful thing to be able to decapitate a baby. You all can go research this online. He said he enjoyed cutting off the head of an infant. That's representative.
Yeah, I've got the link. I've got the link. I'll drop it in the chat room while you're talking.
Yeah, please do. Please do. It's important people know.
Thanks, Tim.
This ideology knows no bounds. It has no limitations. And if the West does not get it together, if the men that have the ability to send people off to war, to do what's necessary, if the resolve, determination, courage, and strength is not put forth in the near future, we're going to have a massive tsunami of death and destruction. It's going to come crashing down on us. That's my last statement.
Thank you, Michael. And Sue from New Mexico joined us earlier in the program. I've unmuted her mic. Sue, if you have any parting thoughts before we close out the show.
Well, you know, I ran across something. Most people have heard it. It's from Golda Meir. She said, "We will have peace when they learn to love their children as much as we love ours." And I think that sums up. Islam has love for no one, even their own children. All it is death and destruction. And a wonderful show again. Thank you.
Sue, thank you so very much, and thank you, everybody. Tim and myself, we are so grateful for the phone calls and people joining us in the chat room. A special thank you to our sweet Sue from New Mexico, Jeff Mitchell of the English Defense League radio show, and, of course, Michael Green of Wounded Warrior. We are down to it. Just a quick programming note to apprise you that Restore Australia with Mike Holt, his show will now be heard 8 p.m. Eastern Time. That is 10 a.m. Thursday mornings in Australia where he is. So please put that in your diaries. But we do want to thank you very much. And believe me, and believe Tim, when we tell you there is a threat out there, and it is called Islam, and ISIS is the latest threat. I don't like calling them ISIS. I just call them the Islamic State because that is what they are. They are engaged in the caliphate. They have cells globally. They are coming to a town near you. Expect to see much more of their capabilities in terms of atrocity. Psychologically affected, not in the sense that they want, not with me. And not with Tim. They are affecting us, and that they are just hardening, like I said, our resolve to defeat the scourge called Islam. It is mass Islamity, and we have to stop the insanity. This is enough. The gloves are off. But, Tim, great show.
Yes, indeed, and thank you, everybody, for listening and being with us tonight. And thanks to our guests, Michael and Jeff and Sweet Sue from New Mexico. And I'm looking forward to seeing you again same time next week. And don't forget to tune in to the other shows that Kel produced, and the other shows that I'm involved in whenever I'm not laid up with my minor health problems, with Freedom Loving Infidels on Tuesday and Islam Exposed on Thursday. And once again, I'd like to say a big thank you to Kel for producing this show in particular, as well as all the others, the best producer a red-blooded male could wish for, as I always say.
I love that.
Does agree with me. And with that, I'll pass the microphone back to you.
And absolutely. And just to remind you, Tim and myself, we are the fellow hosts. We are the freedom-loving infidels that you can hear at the Radio Jihad Network. Tuesday evening, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 p.m. British Summer Time. And tomorrow night, our guests are going to be Golf Dogs and Smokey. And we are going to dissect issues out of the United States, Canada, the U.K., and the issues of Islam. So please join us there tomorrow night, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Thank you guys so very much. Hey, Tim.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Have a great night, eh?
Yes, I will, and you do the same, Kel.
Okay.
And I'll see you very soon.
Good night, guys.
You betcha.
Yeah, good night, guys.
Good night, everybody. Thank you so very much. Thanks, Sue, Jeff, Michael. Thank you, everybody. And we'll see you back here on, Tim and myself, always Mondays, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 p.m. British Summer Time. But, hey, have a great night, all. Talk to you soon. Night, Tim.
Speak to you soon, Kel. Okay, good night.
Keep hope alive. I know sometimes in life you feel that everything is lost, and that mountain is just too high to climb. Keep hope alive. Well, that's when you gotta dig deep down inside and reach that inner strength you never knew you had. Give you the will to carry on another day. And all the day goes by and you're outside, still wondering why, watching everything you work so hard, and life all begins to fall apart. It breaks your heart to see it all crumbling at the wayside. You wanna lay your head down, pack it in and say goodbye, cause there's nothing left here to keep hope alive. Until you see the only two things in life that really matter. It's a little girl and a little boy, want your foolish pride, want your beautiful joy. Even what's left of a candy bar when it's like the remains of a Chips Ahoy. Playing with a piece of driftwood that create a little mind made into a beautiful toy. And at that moment you realize you gotta rebuild everything Mother Nature had just destroyed. Their precious little heartbeats gave you respect over a thousand men. Gave you the will to get back up on your feet again. Because you knew right then this battle wasn't about you, it's all about them. And you reassured them like only a daddy can. And they knew right then that everything was gonna fall. Some harm's way, putting in all those hours, and all my friends working day and night, making it right here, tunnel of towers, bringing us hope like a ray of sunshine, peeking through the clouds.